This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Living free.
Thanks to Rhythm Frequency Radio for another great show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM dial or 3CR on digital radio or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael. And today we've asked our guest Daniel to share their experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. But before we do that, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and to acknowledge that the material and spiritual connection of Aboriginal people to this land was stolen from them. Before we start, we'd like to remind you that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. Please practice self-care and care of others whilst listening. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good. It's great to have you. You could join me in the studio today. We'd like to start the show by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like growing up as Daniel?
Oh, good one right off the bat. Yeah, growing up, I was born and raised in Canada in a town about the size of Geelong, about an hour south of Toronto. Raised by a single mum and a bit of a nuclear family, so her grandparents were involved. And so, a little bit different as my dad was out of my life, but very normal. I was always a little bit of the black sheep, though. Yeah, for reasons I never quite my common sense. I learned early on that my common sense didn't equal other people's common sense, and I was always a little bit awkward and a little bit goofy and quirky. Not that, you know, sometimes very good at paying attention, at other times really not, but quite precocious and imaginative. Life was really good growing up with my mum and my grandparents.
Yep, school. You were okay with school?
Yeah. So I went to public schools, which was in the early years really good. I won't say that I had a fantastic time at high school. I don't think a lot of people do, but no, got through decent grades. But again, not really understanding the whole kind of social constructs. I was never kind of, I was always the misfit. I didn't fit in with sporty people. I didn't fit in with rock people. I didn't fit in with, you know, cliques. And I didn't, being raised by a single mom, I grew up pretty poor. So I never had the cool clothes or, The Nintendo, I'm going to date myself with that one, but yep. I didn't have the Nintendo systems or Sega or whatever else that was going on. So it was, always learning things on the go.
Yeah. Brothers and sisters?
No, I'm a brat. I'm an only child.
Mm-hmm. Spoilt rotten.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, which, yeah, my mother, yeah, she did a great job as good as she can, but, yep.
So, if you're not doing sports and you're not doing, did you have outside school activities that you engaged in that gave you contact with other people?
I didn't really have a lot of social cues until I got into junior high.
What does that look like?
Grade 7 and grade 8, so just, and then grade 9, we all go off to high school, and life really starts to hit.
So 11 and 12 onwards.
Yeah.
Okay, and so then your socializing, did you have a strong group of friends?
I did have a good, strong group of friends. We did play a lot of sport, but I never joined any of the sporting clubs or what do you say, yearbook committee or, I just wasn't involved. But, I did have a group of five or six friends. And it is back in the 80s and 90s where more or less you're shoved out of the door in the early morning, then you go play all day and kind of get out in the world and go and run amok, playing sport and teasing each other and going and making up stuff. It was fun, but yeah.
So did you have that feeling of no disconnection that I speak to, you know, people who have drinking problems, and they what age were you when you started drinking?
Ooh, good question. That kind of goes back a little bit earlier. So I think I started drinking professionally probably at the age of 14.
Yeah, held out as long as you could.
Oh, yeah, no. My grandparents were really good kind of conservative English stock, so and Christian. So I was raised in the Anglican Church and confirmed. And, of course, you know, I started to find that the best part about faith and spirituality was actually the communion wine.
Mm-hmm.
And then on special occasions, my granddad was a Scotch man, and my grandmother was a gin lady, and they had kind of a well-stocked alcohol cupboard at any given time. So if I was very good at family occasions like Easter, Christmas, or those situations, I could sometimes scam like an egg cup or one of those small gin glasses of my grandmother's port wine or sherry. And I still remember the taste and how it hits the tongue and the creamy. Yeah,
Why did that look attractive at that age? Did you see the experience of how alcohol worked with others or worked on others?
Yeah, and I also found even at that first taste or early age, it was almost like a Superman cape. It was the relief. It quieted my mind. It helped me be less introverted,
yep,
but not over extroverted. But it had a little bit of it was a comfort, and it felt quieter in my brain, or easier to engage and easier to enjoy the situation. I didn't feel as confused, curious about things. Life could just kind of do its thing. I didn't know then, but that was moving into high school, grade 9 or 10, being the awkward outsider or a bit of the black sheep, not really knowing what was cool or how to engage girls or friends or what everyone else was on about, and always being kind of how do I kind of facade this, or what am I expected to do here? I found beer took a lot of that insecurity away, and all of a sudden it became a bit of a superpower, you know. So, and because my grandparents' liquor cabinet was stocked so well, it was really, I started to become very popular for being able to take a couple of friends or people over and say, here, have a taste of whiskey. Okay, this is what gin tastes like. This is what vodka tastes like. This is this. And
so what was your first drunk look like? Like when you first started experimenting with alcohol, did you get drunk? Or did you just drink and enjoy the little feeling and you could pull up? Or what did that look like?
I think the first couple of times, I think I can recall three occasions. I can recall the first two just on beer and just getting happy, a little bit snoozy, a little bit comforted. And then I think at one of my birthday parties, my mother was a little bit enabling and allowed me to buy a case of beer for my birthday. And me and a couple of friends went through that, and she was, you know, interested in allowing me to have the drink, but wanted to kind of supervise and see what that looked like. And then one of my friends bought over a 2-liter bottle of Mountain Dew and Southern Comfort.
Oh. sounds particularly sweet.
He was a little bit older. Yeah, it was. And I think that was my first encounter with blackout, kind of drunk.
So what's blackout?
Blackout for me is, you know, I'm conscious, but I'm not, you've gone past happy drunk.
Yep.
And you've gone into other state of drunk where it's not so comforting anymore. And then there's a lot of ritual and a lot of prayer at the porcelain god that kind of comes up. And yes, I went past sick and past hangover into horrible state.
Yep. So what sort of age were you then?
I'd say that was about 15, 16.
And there are consequences for that?
Aside from the bad hangover and a little bit of, there weren't too many consequences.
So when did it become start becoming problematical?
I think it's always been a problem in the build. I think I was born an alcoholic. I just took it to it like water, or a duck takes to water. I don't think it became truly problematic until I emigrated here in 2001 to put the finishing touches on childhood. Through the end of high school, I really started to look forward to the weekends and hanging out with mates, and I started to get into rock and roll because I didn't fit anywhere else. So I started to play guitar and get into music in a big way. And music and alcohol, every time I looked at Much Music or MTV, there was always the videos of the classic Guns N' Roses and Metallica's and Motley Crue's, etc. And just into the grunge era with Nirvana and Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam. And so I kind of decided that was as close as I was going to get to kind of the acceptance, was just to go and be the outsider and play music. And alcohol became a deep part of that was, yep, you know, the alcoholic and the rock and roll lifestyle.
Okay. And then you obviously emigrated to Australia at some stage.
Yeah. I arrived here on April Fool's Day, 2001. And the joke's still on
single?
You. At the tail end of 98, and I had met my now partner and wife. She was going to my hometown university and finishing off an environmental sciences degree, and started to hang around in my local music circles. I fell head over heels. And I guess the simple trick there is she eventually came to tell me that she wasn't going to settle in Canada. She couldn't bear with the winters, and I understand. And that she was going to move back to Melbourne. So I was at a crossroads where, do I stay in Canada and keep my friends, my family, and everything I know? Or do I leave everything, leave family, friends, job, everything behind, and follow my heart and move to Australia?
Yep. And so when, she was cool with you drinking?
Yeah, at the time. Yeah.
Did she drink like you drink?
No. No, she does. She seems to have this little phrase that goes in her head. She kind of actually knows when she's had enough.
Oh, that recognizes it.
Yeah, it's this weird thing, and I've heard it over and over again as you go, but that word, once I've had the first drink, isn't in my vocabulary.
Yeah.
But there are such a thing as people who can have 2 to 5 drinks and say, oh, I'm my happy spot, I'm going to leave it there.
Yeah, they make up the majority.
I had no idea. I thought everyone drank, like, you know, drank to get drunk. So, yeah, that was interesting.
So you came to Australia, and what did that look like?
New environment, and look, everything was new, and part of my brain was like, you know, this is the clean start. This is, you know, it's kind of the Cheers theme song of nowhere go, when you want to go where no one knows your name, and here I am on a different continent, looking for work and settling in and getting, you know, we got married. That first year was kind of a crash course in Australiana. And the one thing that I didn't leave behind was my progressing addiction. Very much welcomed here in Australian life. I can remember meeting a long-term friend at my first job interview, and I got in a little bit of trouble. And I remember walking out of the interview, and this guy said, oh, great, another yank to tease. And that was good. And I made the mistake of commenting on the size of the beer glasses. And I equated the pot glass here in Melbourne to the Dixie cup. Because in Canada, most of us drink pints. And if your beer goes warm while you're drinking pints in Canada, then you're just not taking your beer drinking seriously enough.
Yep.
So here I was in Australia about, you know, 4 weeks in, applying for jobs, and had thoroughly insulted this Aussie on the size of the beer.
Yep.
And he very kindly invited 10 friends and us to go for Friday afternoon beers at 4 o'clock, and showed me the power of the pot, and nice, got me into an Aussie shout. And I don't remember much after about the 7th.
Yep.
I do know I didn't make it to my own shout, and I do know that he had to pour me onto a train. And I made it back to our flat, and I was supposed to take my partner out for a nice evening of a movie, and let me assure you that none of that happened. I was talking, and I was in full ritual to that porcelain nice deity.
You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio. We would encourage our listeners to become regular donors to 3CR. By becoming a regular donor, your ongoing support ensures that we can continue to provide a platform for community issues and struggles. Jump online and go to 3cr.org.au. to become a regular donor or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Today I'm talking to Daniel about alcoholism and his recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. So before the break, you gave us some insight into your introduction to alcohol and leaving Canada to come to Australia with a partner. And maybe we'll move forward a little bit in time and see where alcohol started to become troublesome.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, I think alcohol started to become a bit problematic the more I started to depend on it. So always been a drinker or being able to, love socializing. But there started to be a time when instead of me depending on it, it almost had a dependency on me where it started to make decisions for me, like, what restaurants you would go out to on a date night or starting in to ensure that if I was going out, I would have to have a couple of drinks in me, and then we would go out and do something, and wherever we went had to be licensed. And so it's a little bit about, alcohol security started to in my brain. I think it started to really ramp up and build over about the last 10 years of my drinking, whereby I was really using it as a bit of a cope and crutch. I have a brain that's like 1,000 drunken monkeys running around rattling on, and they're all on cocaine. So yep. Trying to get one salient thought out or trying to cope with, I worked in a very high pressure industry for 11 years, and there was quite a drinking culture involved in that industry as well. So it started to, in small things about, having beer at lunch or kind of de-stressing the morning. You do all your meetings and do the hard stuff, then you go out for lunch and lunches start to get a bit longer. And then you come back to the afternoon and do a bit of a half-assed job. And then I found that there were a couple of colleagues who would like to go out for a bevy after work or a little bit, not at 5 o'clock, let's go out for 4:30. The drinking windows just became more and tighter. And I loved it. I thought it was great. It was helping me cope with the stress. It was helping me focus in a little bit better. It seemed to help me kind of, again, it helped me not care, yeah. Or it helped me debrief, or it helped me suppress my anxieties, or it helped me numb out hard situations. And the reasons for why I wanted to drink just started to become, my justifications and excuses just started to grow, yeah. And everything started to be able to be a situation that, it would be good to have a drink on.
So could you control how much you were having when you were drinking?
Initially, I'd say yeah. But then when I looked to the lengths that I had gone near the end of, you'd have 2 or 3 pints at lunch, and then you would go take your colleague out after work and you'd have 7 or 8 pints after work to debrief the day and talk about the next day's strategy. And then you take a train ride home and stop off after the train ride to have a few drinks at your local little watering hole back at your home station. And that, going for 1 or 2, stay for 7 or 8, and then walk up the hill and then proceed to drink more wine at home at the cost of actually spending time with your loved ones or actually debriefing and having a home life.
So how did that play out? How did it play out in your home life with the, that's a lot of time. Like what time are you getting home?
Usually about 7 or 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And initially, I didn't see a problem with it, but it was becoming more and more a problem. So,
because you were told it was a problem?
My wife, while supportive, was very frequent in saying this is becoming a bit of an issue, or, just the amounts. If you want to be able to drink all the way through life, you're going to have to be able to parcel it out a little bit or taper now. Of course, I didn't listen to that. And I still wasn't getting, prizing how much alcohol I was able to take in, yep. And process. And that kind of amazed me a little bit.
It must sound like it was still manageable. Like you were managing it.
I think I was managing it. Certainly, but I think I started not to be able to manage life. The coping strategies and how I was feeling, my health, absenteeism, short-term memory or being able to recall events or strategies or plans discussed the previous day or week or conversations. And my wife didn't want to hang out with me, if I had, started to drink at around 7 o'clock, and, the distance between relationships just started. And I started to realize I had a bit of a problem as I started to want to isolate. So instead of it being my superpower to help me be extroverted and comfortable and not care, I started to feel that I wanted to isolate, that I couldn't deal with. I'm disempowered. I wanted to disconnect.
I wanted to be alone. Less of a social thing and more of an antisocial thing.
More of an antisocial thing, and I started to disconnect and pull back. And then I suffered... I had a nervous breakdown at the end, in the middle of 2018, and that was my first real danger sign. Of course, I blamed everything except the alcohol. So, you know, I was diagnosed with anxiety, depression, and took me a while to recoup from that. And then I pushed through with work some more. But when I went back to work, my addiction escalated again and just became even more to kind of cope and try to, relieve the stress or get some sleep or try to knock myself out. And this started to produce a couple of trips to the hospital if I would just pass out standing up or those kinds of things, or I would lose my balance or lose consciousness while in the middle of a home activity. So it was becoming not only a bit scary, but a bit embarrassing and humiliating.
Did you try and change your drinking? Did you try and control it? Did you try and stop?
Nope, not at that time. In fact, about a year later, in about February of 2019, where I kind of had another breakdown and actually stopped work and got diagnosed with a workplace injury. In that time for about 3 years, what is an alcoholic to do with 11 extra hours in the day? Mm-hmm. And so it turned into me being a daily top-up drunk. Yep. And it was really rough on the family, really rough on parents and friends and my partner and myself. And I started to get deeper and deeper into a depression of just finding everything useless and finding myself angry and resentful and frustrated with people, places, things, situations, parties, countries, friends, yep. And isolating even more and more and drinking more and more.
So what brought you to your knees? What was the last thing that happened where you went, actually, I can't do this anymore?
I knew I had a problem about 5 years ago, to tell you the truth. And that problem started to be that I started to think that things had gone far enough and I was not having fun and I was not enjoying anything and I was missing out on family events, opportunities to be of service, just being alive. And I had every intention of wanting to stop or slow down my drinking and came to a very horrible realization that I couldn't.
Yep.
I thought I had the delusion of being in control and thought I could handle it if I was just had a little bit of willpower, a little bit of intelligence, a little bit of knowledge. But I found that I couldn't break the cycle. And I was actually, all my justifications and excuses and the reasons why I was drinking was no longer helping any of that.
So had you tried professionals? Did you counseling?
Yeah, I started therapy? I've been seeing therapists, and I did a sort of psychologist and a psychiatrist who I still see now. But as far as the alcohol, nothing was beating up against the wall. And eventually my wife kicked me out of, we separated, and for good reason. And I spent a couple of months, I put myself into a rehab. And then over that 9-month period, we slowly talked and worked around reconciliation. But yeah, for 9 months, I was out on my ear, really. Mm-hmm. And, but for my higher power and really good friends, really amazing supporting friends who made sure I wasn't going to be on the street, that was one. That wasn't enough to convince me. And I moved back in and I was still trying to bring in harm minimization. So if I could control, yep. How much I was spending, control when I started to drink and I only spend this much money. So when it's gone, it's gone. I was still under the delusion that I could taper it or control it. And yet again, it failed.
So what was the last thing? The last thing that happened?
The last thing that happened is my partner had asked me to be available on a weekend. Very gave me a heads up on a Friday night that we were going to be looking after someone on the Saturday. A young one asked me if I could just kind of taper off. You know, she didn't put the barrier down and say no drinking. She just said, could you make sure that your copus mentis has it work? And you, if I need a little bit of help tomorrow afternoon, can you be available? And of course, hand on heart and promises and values and ideals and principles, I was, you know, of course, I was very happy to commit to that. Only Saturday morning came around, and by about 2:30 in the afternoon, I was completely pickled.
Yep.
And I had gone to pass out in my bed and have an afternoon nap, and was completely not present, not available, not useful. And I think, I can't remember at the time, but I think I probably tried to get up to go to the loo and managed to pass out and fell flat on my face and kind of cracked my cheekbone and split my lip and was unresponsive. So the thing that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me was it was another trip to hospital, another blackout drunk, and what would have happened if the youngin' had come in and found me as opposed to my partner mm-hmm. bleeding that all over the floor? What kind of damage would that do?
So what happened then? What was the next? So this is it?
So that was it. So I had another fantastic trip to the hospital in an ambulance, not knowing what was going on. Long story short, yes, I had a commitment to kind of come back out and go back to rehab. Long story short, I woke that morning and said, no, that put, after the car ride home early in the morning saying, that's, you know, oh, I just need to get back on track. I'm going to have to really tighten the belt and really give this a proper go. I woke up that morning after sleeping off and I couldn't stand to live this way anymore. And I can't live like this. I've now lost my integrity as well, and I can't keep my promises, I can't keep my ideas, and my principles have gone out the window.
Cool. Well, we're going to stop there. I'm talking to Daniel about alcoholism and his recovery with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. So before we went to the break, you were just, you know, you reached the stage, you'd made that decision that you'd had enough. You're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and you'd hit what we would call a rock bottom. So, and there's more to come. We get them all again. But what actions did you take once you made the decision that you weren't going to drink anymore?
Three main kind of points. My wife and I decided to take a trip, and we went away to Bali for a month, which I thought would be really good and relaxing. And while I did not drink while I was over there and managed to get a month of sobriety up, I was absolutely miserable. Because, you know, one thing when you put down the booze, all the emotions, all the fears, all the stuff that you haven't been dealing with starts to crop back up. And I was really miserable. So when we came back from that trip, I put myself went back to rehab. And had a much better experience this time, but it was still, you know, feeling unhappy. And so when I came out of rehab that third time, I made the decision to go and have a look at an Alpha AA group. And I had lots of preconceived notions and prejudices and crap going on in my head, but I wanted to go and have a look because I really didn't, you know, the psychologists hadn't been working, the medications hadn't been working, psychiatry wasn't working, rehabs hadn't been working. I was at, gotta do something different. And I walked into the doors of AA for the first time.
The place of last resort.
Should be the place of first resort, my God. What was amazing is I finally felt that I was in a room of somewhere I belonged. People were actually being really honest, really vulnerable. They were, you know, by listening to, going to a couple missing meetings and listening hard, I started to hear my own story coming through other people's lips. They pinned me down or had my story better than I could ever say it, and were talking about the same experiences, the same feelings, the same trouble, this problem. And they had a language for it, and that led through this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a whole language, whole theories about, you know, a medical opinion on the disease. and it being physical and mental, and that some of us are just different that way inclined. So all I started to learn information, and I finally started to feel that I belonged, that I wasn't the lone gunman, or wasn't the lone shadow goofy guy who no one understands, and, you know, I didn't feel like such an enigma. I started to go to more and more meetings, and I met more people with really amazing stories. Some people had gone much further than I did, and some people were coming in trying to get a handle on it before they got to some of those stages. And it has made such... The first 6 months were just amazing. The stories alone, and I thought, okay, I'll do this once a week and it'll be fine. But no, I actually started to go more often. And I heard a lot of wisdom in the rooms of go to a meeting like you used to drink and listen to the similarities, not the differences, and just keep rocking up. So my life now is it's unrecognizable from where I was 2.5 years ago. Being part of something, feeling that I belong and that I'm safe and that we're exploring and able to talk openly, honestly, willingly, and vulnerably to each other is fantastic, as well as getting involved. And, you know, there's a lot of recommended things that go in the book. And I have found for myself that it's just opened so many doors, so much understanding about myself, but also it's that reconnecting force, yeah, that I've really identified with. And instead of, it's combating that isolation that really got me into a hole. So my partner and I are doing really well. I'm doing the recommended things. I'm studying to recertify. I'm ready for kind of, I'm starting finally to come out of, coming out the other end, starting to be ready, feeling comfortable in my own skin, being able to have difficult conversations and be present, being not as judgmental, having some self-care and some self-regard. So, you know, healthy self-esteem and being, as I said, comfortable in my own skin. And being intrigued and enticed by the world as opposed to being afraid of it.
So what actions are you required to do to get that?
I've come to take what's recommended pretty seriously. So I go to regular frequent meetings. I talk to other members where I can, as often as I can. They make recommendations of regular frequent meetings. I have myself a home group that I go to. I get involved and try to be of service to others. In these groups.
Describe that a home group is a place, it's the meeting that you go to on every week and you're accountable to be there. And so when you're not there, someone's going to call you and say, hey, weren't you there? Why weren't you there? Because the temptation is to go to a meeting. Like there's on offer, there's hundreds of meetings across Melbourne every week, you know, daytime, morning, you know, morning, daytime, evening, late afternoon, overnight. You can do it on, you know, online. But that's the simple thing to do, is just to shop around and be everywhere and not really be accountable, but plonking our butts into a meeting and taking on a service position. What that looks like is, you know, well, you might be the person standing at the front, shaking hands with the person coming in the door and just checking out the people who are there for the first time and making them feel welcome. Or it might be just helping pack up, or it might be becoming the treasurer of the group, or being the person who's leading the meeting on that particular night,
or the person who's picking up the milk and bickies for the rest of the group. Important. There's lots of different positions.
So you become accountable. Home group.
And then I'm getting a sponsor and actually starting to do the work that's listed in there. So there is, through the book, there is a really well laid out recommended action steps.
Yep.
And it really works if you work it. From being a full-time, I had a pretty raw 35-year drinking career that escalated and progressed really well. If you had asked me 2.5 years ago whether I would be sober, I would have told you you were full of it. If you would tell me that I would be happily sober, I would have never believed you at all. But life is really, really good, much more stable, clearer, being present, not waking up with stinking hangovers, being available to my partner, going back to study, getting excited about doing something new, coming on a radio program, and just really enjoying it. There is a way out, there is a solution, and I'm kind of living it and really enjoying it.
Because I guess my experience is that I've discovered I don't have a drinking problem, I have a living problem.
Yeah.
And alcohol solves my living, the difficulty I have living comfortably in my own skin. And if I could just have a couple of drinks, I'd be I'd be a couple of drinks drunk all the time.
Mm.
But and I can't, because I have a physical thing that makes me, once I start, I can't stop. And then I've got the consequences of being drunk all the time. And so, you know, I need to go and find a way to live life. And AA certainly offers the book Alcoholics Anonymous actually is a textbook, and it gives us some clear-cut directions about what we need to do and how we should go about it. And it doesn't tell us exactly what the results will be, but if we go to enough meetings, we'll watch the people that have already done it display and put on out on display for us to see the way they lived their lives happily.
Yeah.
And
I certainly met people who had what I wanted. Now I get to work with, I'm starting to be able to work with others as well, and they start to identify and ask questions or ask the privilege of whether I'm able to sponsor them. So it comes and goes. It's sometimes really quickly and sometimes slowly for others.
Yeah.
Once
amazing,
you get into the middle,
because you would have, I know that for me, it's that I would never have thought that the things that happened in my drinking were going to become an asset. I still get the cringes with them, but the fact that I can pass on my experience of this is what it looked like, and this is what I've done, and this is how it looks now. Those horrible things that happened and the things that I did when I was drinking actually become an asset, because the next person that comes in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous hears me share honestly about them, and goes, oh yeah, I've had that. Yeah, I felt that. I think that. And that, you know, we all sit there and in meetings with the, like, bobbleheads, where the heads just go, yep.
I've done that.
I've done that, or I could have done that, or geez, I imagine I might have done that, and maybe I did it when I can't remember it. But that stuff is now an asset, and it frees us from the guilt and the shame that comes with that
and behavior. Some of the overthinking. Yeah, and again, it's always in the back of, you know, it doesn't go away. You know, there's still a little part in the background doing push-ups, waiting for the opportunity to kind of convince me or use one of my old justifications. Because if there's a day that ends in Y, I can come up with at least 10 reasons why I could have a drink.
Yeah.
The funny thing is I don't want to.
No.
And I'm able to really see that clearly, and life is so much better without it. The comparison between the two states of being where I was and how I'm feeling now and what's coming next, wouldn't trade my best drunken day for my worst sober day at the moment.
Awesome.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.